We are back with another episode of The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie Romano Pugh.
Hello, everyone. This is Jakob, and we're, that's what I said, back. Here to talk about another episode of the hit HBO show, The Wire.
Yeah, thank you for that. If you have been listening to us all this time and you want to help out, as always, go to anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. Sorry, it's a mouthful. I want to get it out quickly.
That was good.
Leave us 5 stars in the reviews on the Apple Podcast app. Give us a nice review if you so please. We're here to talk about
Season 3, Episode 10, Reformation.
Thank you, yeah. And if you didn't know what the theme of the season was by this point, this episode pretty much spells it out for you in a lot of ways. So let's set forth on what's brewing in the drug war in Baltimore between Avon and Marlowe's people.
Well, we're kind of having a pre-discussion. Since we're able to do that now, it's a lot easier than just awkwardly fumbling around on Zoom and stuff. But, you know, there's bodies piling up, literally and figuratively. Well, quite literally, we see a murder scene, and it's one of Marlowe's guys, right? It's right. Fruit's friend or one of his crew members, but we were trying to figure out the name, and I don't know at this point. Looks familiar, but I'm sure we'll figure it out. Like, we'll do our due diligence.
Yeah.
And get to the bottom of it. Like we do about everything. I know we talk about this show like in storylines, going through each one in its entirety if you haven't picked up on our new format, but sometimes the sequence of individual scenes
maybe gets fuzzy.
Is this an argument to go back to individual scene based podcast episodes? And then we see, and we go there, and then we see, we get to see. We should make a super cut of, and then we get to see. Yeah, we're literally seeing every scene. Jeez. Yeah. All right, if you're still listening, we love you. Yeah,
you could watch the episode twice because some of the earlier episodes ran so long. Yeah. You could just watch the episode twice with our podcast commentary.
2 hours of, and then we get to see, they're in the stairwell. Maybe we should have just kept it, like. Nah, that'd be too much.
Yeah,
hey, guys, there's a podcast where they go through every scene of The Wire and break down every scene, like, chronologically.
I like this format better.
More fun.
Yeah.
But apparently people that we've told about are, like, sympathetic to, like, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to, you know, talk about a show, like, without going through every scene, right?
Yeah.
Or, like, probably. No, you don't even know. You haven't listened to it then.
I mean, in more, like, linear shows, maybe, like, where the focus is more narrow, like, but the thing with The Wire is that there's, like, a bajillion characters that you're hopping from,
it's still complicated.
Suffice it to say that things are heating up between the two crews. Avon's kind of, like, losing his, I'd say, like, kind of losing his grip on reality, or maybe just, like, taking the normal trajectory of, like, a typical drug kingpin, and he's trying to take no prisoners, and Marlowe's not backing down either, and it's setting off some infighting in the New Day co-op. It's bad stuff. We also have Brother Muzon coming back to...
He's coming back. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. We get treated with, like, a rare Brother Muzon Lamar special this episode. So, you put it more succinctly. I'm going to get better at referring to just, like, the notes here. What is going on with Brother Muzon? Because Lamar has no idea where they're at, which it's pretty funny. Like, it's ironic that guy from Baltimore, it's like, what? Where are we? You know, he obviously knew his way around, but he said, what's Muzon reading? And Lamar is just reading maps, but
like, they're in the hotel in, like, the cold opening scene. And yeah. it seems like, I don't know, his brother moves on, like, reading another edition of Harper's Bazaar. Yeah. Like, he's reading some, like, you know, intellectual stuff in Lamar. And it's just, like, reading the maps, trying to get, like, he really doesn't know where he is. It's so funny. Nice little contrast there between those two members. They're a good odd couple, I guess.
Oh, yeah, we're going to talk a little more about those two and Lamar. But, yeah, I mean, he tells him, right, like, we're in Baltimore.
Maryland.
There you go. Woo! Yeah. Lamar's, I mean, he's, I don't really have much evidence that he's a geo genius, but I think, I don't know. I mean, I think he's trying.
DeAndre McCullough, yeah.
I mean,
you know, character is not the same as the person, but he pulls off the bewilderment pretty convincingly.
Yeah, so... They stop. It looks like they were looking for, you know, Franklin Terrace, right?
Yeah.
Which they find, but it's...
completely raised. Yeah.
Yeah. Just like my hands were. Completely raised.
Different spelling, though.
Yeah. Right? Okay.
Yeah. Damn, your fucking hands disappeared. They got raised. And
oh, I thought something was wrong with my hands because they've been tingling like oddly lately.
I get those. I think we both need to get like a EKG or something to determine. Well, I think I like to determine if I have like heart trouble or something.
That's it. I mean, I've had those before. It's freaky.
Circulation issues. I don't know.
I'm getting a nerve. Okay, I don't want to get too close. no, but like I thought you saw something on my hand. You're like, damn, your hands are... because... everyone, yeah. Willie's a really good actor. You don't know if he's like, where it's like a slider, you know, you never know where he's coming from. Nah. It's good. It's fun, but it's also freaky.
Yeah. Speaking of freaky, we, no, oh. I don't know. Speaking of, okay, sure. Let me try and,
yeah.
Speaking of freaky, LaTroy and his friend are getting scolded by Snoop.
Wait, but is it LaTroy? I thought they say they got LaTroy. So
Oh fuck. Oh my god. I'm fucking up here.
It's okay. Sorry. I mean I don't know what was freaky about that, but it's freaky the way you're like trying to freak me out with your like alternate like storylines and stuff.
No, but, I'm just bad with face. Like there's an abundance of like faces on the show and I get confused.
It's the kid who's going to be schooled with the boxing, right? Him and his buddy. They're like, ah, oh, man. So they hear gunshots, but then they run right to where someone just got shot. But we can assume that, you know, those weren't the shots that killed LaTroy, but maybe just a retaliatory barrage.
There's just shots ringing out everywhere like, throughout the city it's chaos and war right now.
And then Snoop is just cruising around all cool and calm and Snoop like, and just, you know, like, what are you doing? And they're just like, chips? I mean, those chips are, I mean, when they say, you know, sugars, fat, salts are designed to addict people, especially in, you know, low income areas. They're not lying, you know. It's like it's a food desert. They probably only got a few corner stores.
Yeah.
And they gotta risk their lives to get chips, you know. It's a pretty stark reality.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe they could just like stay home, and if their parents or if they, you know, family had like an apple, but they probably I'm wondering if there were like healthy options at home, would they still risk their, I mean, they're teenagers. They like, we probably still gone. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the, side effects or consequences of having a bunch of kids enter the drug game at a really early age. They really, get a warped sense of their priorities and decide to like brave through like a battlefield in order to get some, spicy hot Cheetos, flavored hot Cheetos.
Takis or something.
Yeah.
But, oh man. So yeah, I mean, we're seeing where the chips fall, lie, settle.
I mean, he still had the chips as he was running away, right?
Oh, I'm trying to make like, what is that metaphor or something? Where like, yeah, where the chips may like,
where, yeah, the chips may fall.
Fall. Man, yeah. I got it. I mean, we're gearing up for a solid Vegas trip, I'm assuming this summer, right? So I better.
Oh, yeah. We better make everything into a gambling metaphor.
I can't bungle this at Binion's. All right, but anyways, real talk. McNulty's like, we need to do this about the wiretaps. I don't know, this whole wiretap thing, it's like the third time now, and it's all track phones, so it just gets kind of...
Yeah, very complicated, convoluted stuff. I feel like we don't need to get, like, too in the weeds or the details of, like, every little plan they're making with this whole scheme.
What are some of the things that did stand out about what the cops and the prosecutors and stuff are doing this episode? Like, I'm asking a question in person is way more like awkward now.
We've forgotten how to talk.
You do know me, right?
Yeah.
We've literally had conversations since we were like 2 decades.
Yeah.
2 decades long at least. Anyways.
But I just think it's so funny that like McNulty is like so far out of the realm of like what's possible in the detail that he's like trying to tell Perlman like, oh, like we need to like redo the affidavit.
Oh. Yeah. I was going to say that was, thank you for bringing this up. You know, I was going to say about this, right?
What?
She's like, are you a lawyer? And he's like, you know, who would want to be,
or who would,
who would pretend to be a lawyer that isn't? And I was thinking of somebody.
Norris.
Norris. Who, you know, if you haven't heard our content on Norris Davis, who plays Vincent, episode 2 of this,
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, this season. So anyways, yeah, he pretended, I guess, or they thought he did. Well, he was representing like a family member or something in a civil case. And they're like, dude, you can't be here anymore. Because he's a schemer. Yeah. And we're going to talk more about Vincent later.
Yeah. Because
it's always entertaining. But yeah, I mean, to your point, is he going overboard of what McNulty would even consider overboard because he's in this weird crisis where he's like,
it has to be all related, right? Because he's like, he's kind of like coming up against the like edges of what he could realistically do, like in his position in law enforcement. So he's like trying to think outside the box and like, take on like all kinds of new angles and in an effort to like feel valid or give his life meaning or whatever. So yeah, it has to be all connected. I mean, we also see him like break all kinds of like traffic laws and like go on like a crazy like stalking chase when he sees like someone with red hair that may or may not be B.D. Russell, and he like instantly loses his cool.
Oh, white woman. Ah. anyways, but yeah, I think that was one of the things, you know, we wanted to talk about with this, but also Freaky Phelan.
Oh yeah.
What is that? It's a lot more than I remember.
Yeah, me too. Definitely did not like, I mean, I probably realized it was happening at the time, but like the way that Perlman kind of like diverts his attention to her legs in order for them to like get a leg up on the affidavit and everything, probably wouldn't. I don't know. It would attract a lot more controversy if the show was written today, I could imagine. But that's just something I wanted to point out. I don't know. I guess it's not that. I mean, it's like, it's almost like kind of like a weird dynamic where it's like playing into the power coupleness of Daniels and like Perlman. Like he's like approving of it. Like, yes, like you used it to get us ahead in the investigation.
Dude, they're like a interracial, like, pre-Mosby couple.
Pre-Mosby?
Yeah, like, you know, the Mosbys are like the current power couple, like the city council president and the, you know, state's attorney.
Right.
It works to their favor, right? Daniels is like, okay, whatever. Let him speak French to my lady if it gets us these. I mean, is he like just along for the ride in those moments where she, you know, Perlman is all surprised that he just signed off on basically pre-tapping a phone without probable cause. I mean, they have probable cause based on all the stuff that they're hearing, but you know, there isn't like someone hasn't used it to commit a crime yet. The phone that they're working on, you know, getting in the hands of Bodie and, you know, the Barksdales, right?
Right. Exactly.
Daniels is like, cool.
Yeah. And I think it also, like, I have a feeling that, like, Phelan isn't aware of Cedric and Rhonda's relationship at this point, because there is, like, weird dynamic in the first season whenever McNulty and Perlman and Phelan were in the same room, like, Phelan was getting, like, hostile towards him and, like, being generally, like, unhelpful and playing that whole game with him.
He was like, yeah, he's dumb, you know. There's no way. And then with this, what could throw him off, right?
Yeah.
About Daniels.
It's terrible.
Am I problematic?
Yeah. I mean, you're not endorsing that view at all. I think you're just kind of like speaking to the reality of how like inherently bigoted a lot of these people in the show are.
Yeah, I mean, Phelan has strong, smartest guy in the room vibes, like almost as bad as McNulty in his context, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So he's probably like, psh, whatever.
But Phelan is learning how to, the difference between him and McNulty is like Phelan is learning how to thrive in his environment, whereas McNulty is like, oh, I need like someone to give me a key to go to the top floor of this hotel so I can get laid. Like, I'm not politically smart at all. Like, I'm smarter than everybody here, but still nobody wants me. Where?
I'm just a breathing machine for my
dick.
Is that right? I'm not endorsing this.
You're just quoting.
And Willie is not depicting it.
Depiction doesn't equal endorsement, especially when it comes to this podcast where we talk about the filthy minds on the wire.
Yeah, I endorse that.
Okay.
I mean, the end result of this is all to get some pre-tap phones in the hands of Bubbles, who, I mean, I know you got some strong Bubbles takes. They're like, here, sell all these phones,
but you
don't get to keep any of it. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I've already, like, reiterated it many times. Like, they're running, like, this weird, like, exploitation game with him where they're just, like, dependent on him to continue his drug habit so they could continue their investigation and not like really looking out for his well-being. He was fucking like clean in the first season before Kima got shot, but then like as soon as Kim Nolte re-enters his life, they're like oh, you have a drug problem, that's nice, go risk your life for us so we can get some intel. Like,
yeah, and forget Holly, because he beat Bubbles.
Yeah.
Not even knowing the context of anything.
Exactly.
And that definitely contributes. I mean, because you're just got clean and then you get your ass kicked and you're in pain. I'm sure you're going to want to, you know, some relief. He's got no health care.
Right.
It's all a mess, man.
Yeah.
I know. It's pretty bad. I didn't notice this as much either. So I'm glad I'm here again watching the show. I mean, just because the show is fun to watch most times.
Yeah.
But also that you're illuminating all these themes and, you know.
Yeah. I also, like, you know, when...
I'm serious.
Thanks,
man. I know you think I'm messing with you.
No, that's good. Because
I do that, too. Willie's not the only one that you can't tell sometimes what the hell he's getting at. If you can tell. If you don't know us by now, I mean, we're both, you know, I'm more of the jerk, but...
We're wacky. But it's like, so it's like, we talk a lot about like how certain characters on the show, like especially McNulty and like I even mentioned in this Google Doc, Bunny at one point, channel like Ed Burns's id. Is it the id or the ego?
Probably like the ego, or it is like the more.
Fuck. Anyway,
ego like, is like, oh yeah, maybe I missed the whole point of what 10th grade English or
but they kind lore. Of yeah
anyway
they kind of channel Ed Burns's like ideological views through their actions and like what they talk about and stuff. So I was like kind of thinking like, oh yeah, like maybe McNulty is like getting disillusioned with his position, like maybe similar to like what Ed Burns was going through before he decided to become a teacher. But then also his relationship with Bubbles is almost kind of like Ed Burns's like fraught interactions with Andre Royo on the set, like when Andre Royo would come up to him and like ask him about the ball game, and he's like, "Fuck, like what? Talk about something real for once. Like, why do we have to talk about stupid shit like this?" And maybe, maybe it's just his MO for McNulty to. He had it out for Andre Royo somehow. I don't know. It's bizarre.
Bubbles gets to talk to, finally, he runs game on Squeak, who he has a prior relationship with. And he just shows how, even in his state of, you know,
oblivion.
I mean, he must be messed up with, you know, he's making more money probably than he usually has. So I don't know what happened to all those capsules or vials that he, all the vials that he was able to buy, right? Like get his deal on, discount on when doing undercover work in Amsterdam. But I mean, he's smooth. I mean, he gets Squeak to buy the phone. I mean, he does it pretty brilliantly, but I wanted to talk a little about the reference he makes in Squeak's background, because I never noticed this at all.
Let's get into Turtle Wells.
Yeah, you know, Turtle Wells. That is great. When you heard that name, like what percentage of you was thinking this? Yeah, this is definitely a callback to someone.
I was definitely thinking like, I can't wait for Jakob paragraphs. I can't wait for Jakob's little write up on this, because I know he's going to.
Okay, well, I had no confidence that I was going to be able to find anything.
Yeah.
But maybe it's such an obscure sounding reference that it made it easier. Because it is definitely a real person, because he mentions that, oh yeah, you know, she slimmed down, she looks really good, she used to rob back with Turtle Wells and the old mob. And I was like, what the hell does that even mean? But get this, so his name was James H. Wells, and the first story I found about him, in 1977 he was being held on murder and kidnap charges out in a Baltimore County jail, and he escaped somehow with like three other dudes, and they went on the run. And I guess him and his main partner, you know, out of the group that made their way out of there, was named Sonny Jackson. And you know, they were on the run for a little bit longer than the other guys, but they ended up getting caught. But apparently They were there. I know, you know, I'm laughing at like murder, kidnap charges, but when you hear the story, you know, trust me, he's not going to be, you know, like the worst guy in the light that I think this might be portrayed if you didn't hear the full context. But basically, when he and Sonny Jackson committed a heist, or they were trying to rob a jewelry store in Ellicott City, which is, you know, like out in the county, they basically took the owner hostage, and then in the ensuing chase, when they're all trying to get away with him still in the car, a county cop from Howard County shot and killed the owner of the jewelry store. So you know, they still got charged with the murder, but they didn't actually kill anyone. So to my knowledge, James Turtle Wells isn't like some mass murderer kidnapper guy, because it sounded really bad when I read the hell. I'm like, man, this is what Simon's bringing up? Like, this murder, kidnapping, that's crazy. I mean, I know I've spent a lot of time talking about people who committed a lot of really heinous crimes, but to my knowledge, you're just a robber, which makes sense, because that's, you know, the relationship Bubbles references and the parallels, you know, he draws with Squeak. But so, sorry, but it's just crazy because, so basically, the whole robbery angle, I believe, is also because apparently Turtle Wells and his guy Sonny Jackson pulled off the biggest heist in Maryland state history. They robbed a branch of the Maryland Central Bank out at the BWI, the Baltimore Washington International Airport, and they stole like 500 grand. Turtle Wells was on one, man.
Squeak is on one.
Yeah, Squeak, yeah. But I mean, this, you know, I blur the lines, which is like the purpose, just getting this like insanity where I'm like, what? But this is the mid 70s. So Squeak must like, she looks better than Bubble is giving credit for, because I mean, mid 70s. So she must be in her late 50s.
No. They blurred the lines for sure.
But get this, the guy who, you know, rest in peace, who got shot by the cop and then, you know, horrible Turtle. Turtle got charged with the murder. His name was Bernard Sugar. Squeaking Bernard, baby. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's probably just a coincidence.
Sugar, Domino Sugar. Oh, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I'm like, this is so like in reality, people are actually just compositions of things that happened in The Wire. Like, like we're all living in a simulation that's dictated by The Wire.
We David Simon and Ed Burns created our Matrix.
Oh my God, that's great. But yeah, sad stuff with Bernard Sugar, but I don't know. Oh yeah, they also hid a portion of the money out by Jessup by The Cut.
Right.
That's where they apparently 400 grand when they cooperated, like, okay, we'll show you where the money is so we get like a lighter sentence or whatever for the robbery. They hid like 400 grand by a farm out in Jessup. So
yeah,
maybe there's like some relationship with the, you know, okay, it's more than just a jail. Yeah. There's a town there, I guess.
Yeah.
Before we move on to Colvin, like Lester's, like he, like his undercover groove. I mean, this is something I definitely remember. Man, I'm like, but maybe not. I didn't remember to the degree of like how bad he makes people like Herc look undercover. We're like, Lester's smooth with it.
We got Lester operating on all fronts this episode. We see him with the triple threat. We see him with his tiny furniture.
Yeah.
We see him running the phone computer game, Intel, whatever. We see him in his undercover operation donning a gold cap on one tooth and adopting the whole Baltimore accent really subtly. He does the tooth.
Yeah. Man, this man, I mean, hey, Clark Peters did buy a home in Charles Village, so he was really tapped into the culture.
I mean, it's a, like, he's a really amazing actor. I'm watching Treme right now. And
he's going Big Chief in this episode.
Nice.
Yeah, man. Anything else about Lester's undercover work? I mean,
excellent work.
So what? Bernard's just like, whatever, I want to make more money.
Yeah,
and get Squeak off of me, because Squeak is hardcore.
Yeah, she is hard. I mean,
she ran with Turtle, man.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, earlier on in the show, she was really reading Bernard the Riot Act, and now it makes more sense. Like, yeah, I don't want to cross my girlfriend. She's gonna.
How convenient that now there's some guy pops up out of nowhere and like, yeah, I could hook you up, and you'll make more money, and just get to stay around town, and you know. Carolyn can make bingo night and everyone's happy.
Yeah.
All right, more cop stuff. You want to talk about Colvin?
Yeah. You know, as McNulty is kind of lamenting about the direction the case is going and is, you know, getting in a fight with the top brass, Colvin kind of drops him a golden nugget by way of a stringer and gives him Avon's 411.
Oh, yeah. That was our smooth transition in. Damn, I totally. That was great, though. Colvin nugget. Nice. Oh no!
I mean, he is a bunny, right? He found the golden egg.
Yeah, and this is a turtle race.
Oh my god! Yeah,
a turtle whales race.
Yeah,
So he's getting hooked. Yeah, he's laying it out there for.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about what he thinks about like Bushy Top, because one of the main, you know, what I found aside from obviously him revealing everything that's going down in Hamsterdam, he has a conversation with Carver.
Yeah. So
it's about being police. So
exactly.
He had some you know, things that you wanted to talk about, or just, you know, observations like, does he think Carver's the worst cop?
Yeah, it's like, it seems like Carver at this point, you know, he's reached a evolution in the arc of his character where, you know, he was kind of like, he seemed remorseful and apologetic when he was, you know, getting read the riot act by Lieutenant Daniels in season one, only to like kind of fuck him over, by going behind his back and then, you know, up and quitting on him in the second season. But it seems like Colvin is like trying to impart some wisdom and some lessons onto him. And, he seems rather stoic and pissed off about it, but as we see throughout the course of the rest of the series, you know, like it seems like he kind of takes to heart like a lot of the things he's saying about like the state of the drug war and whatnot. And again, this is like it's totally him channeling Ed Burns, like for real. Like this must have been the conversations, like internal or otherwise, he was having like in a, you know, as his police career was dwindling down or whatnot. But there's also like a unique difference in the way he like talks with Carver and the way he talks with McNulty. Like it almost seems like they're already on the same page about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, Jimmy's natural police, right? They love to, I mean, this is kind of this, like these, one of the central theses of the show, right? Where it's like, the drug war has ruined police work. Yeah. And when this is like a refresher to kind of provide context to when you see Simon ripping into people about the whole abolish the police movement. Like this is just the dumbest, like anyone who believes that, you know, it's just your quacks or whatever. And then you're like, oh man. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's what he said. And then you know, watch this episode and it's like, good old police work. That's what it should be about.
Yeah.
Police.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a million other examples why Simon would think the way he does, but
yeah,
you know, it's like pretty much, you know, it's definitely progressive for the time that this came out. Right.
Yeah.
I don't want to have like recency bias with everything that's going on, but.
Well, I mean, this show like totally talked about, the intricacies of, what it takes to be a cop that no other cop shows were really approaching at the time. But yeah, like a lot
still,
of...
Still. I mean,
yeah.
It's not complete copaganda.
Yeah.
It's not even... You know,
it really is like just towing the line like all throughout the series, which is why I think it's still so effective at provoking a lot of wide-ranging conversations almost like 20 years later after it first premiered.
We're here. We're here still.
Yeah. But as we all know, this is just a simulation. This is all fake and none of this really matters.
No, so. No.
Malfunction. Do not compute.
I mean, but you kind of mentioned Carver being were you referencing like stoicism? He's taking it in, but I wanted to ask your thoughts on, you know, when Colvin's saying, you know, do you understand? Like, basically saying, like, you feel me? What?
Yeah.
And then he's kind of like, kind of. Is he that unaware? Or is he just kind of say, like, he's pushed, like, I got to push back a little. I'm getting humiliated right now.
Yeah. I think it's, like, kind of the latter because, like, he probably does feel, like, a little pissed off because, you know, he did kind of stick his neck out to up and move a dead body like out of the jurisdiction.
Thanks for dragging that dead body away from me.
Yeah. I mean,
sounds ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, Colvin was right to tell him that was a stupid idea. He's like, I see, you know, your heart was in the right place, but, you know, don't let it fucking happen again. Yeah,
but that guy's heart is over there and it's leaking blood everywhere. Yeah. Do you understand? Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
But yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's fine.
But you answered the latter, right?
He's
not that dumb.
Yeah.
He's, you know, like you said, you're not like, I know I'm harder on Carver and some of the cops probably like in certain contexts, but maybe it's also because I lack like sometimes the ability to articulate, you know, like just like lurch murder. And you're like, but Carver, you know, you're not afraid to really, you know, try to expound on these things where I'm like, yeah, so Willie, you're like Carver, you know, he's trying to figure it out. Jeez, it's you're getting too invested in this simulation that doesn't matter. Let's just stick to endorsement and, you know, depiction or whatever. Let's just stick to that rule.
Yeah.
I think we pretty much wrapped the whole Carver thing, right? But
yeah,
Bunny has a much bigger problem because Herc is you know, singing and he's snitching to Babinski. What is up with that? Is this a real person too? I didn't look into it.
Yeah.
Is this like a reporter that Simon didn't really hate, but kind of just is like analogous to something else that happened in the Sun Papers?
I don't know.
Sun Papers? What is that?
Deep state
rag.
No, it's not. It's a good paper. It's a good, you know. Yeah, I don't like, you know, Herc is a fucking little snitch bitch punk ass motherfucker, dude. Like, how is he gonna go from like conspiring with like the hoppers to like have fun with the identikit in one instance, but then totally turn against them and blow up, you know, his own superior's well-intentioned efforts at the same time.
See, we can't even have fun and compare him to Jenkins because Jenkins would have torn Herc. He's like, you know, to those of you who are out there wondering what the hell we're talking, you know, Wayne Jenkins from We Own This City, the book that's coming out, of course, Gun Trace, but he's like Herc, like evolved state. Like if this is a simulation, it's like someone dumped like gallons of PCP into it. And then we get Jane. Like, he'd be like, you snitch.
Yeah.
He has no faith that Colvin never was going to prosecute anyone, but at least the other cops chain of command, right?
Yeah, he's just being a jerk. Like, what is he getting out of it? Like, he's just trying to control the narrative and like...
I can't sleep. When I go home to my county residence, just what's going on here keeps me up at night. It's like...
Yeah.
Okay, terrible.
No, I mean, at least you're trying, bro.
I guess I didn't try last week, everyone. Well, he's like, at least today you're bringing something. okay. So, yeah, I mean, but man, what a bluff, right?
Yeah.
Colvin's just like, everyone knows.
Yeah, he really.
So is this a bluff or is he already... He's already come to terms with the fact that he has to.
Well, I feel like it's part like because he knows that the Sun is about to report on it, that pushes him into being honest during the Comstat meeting.
Okay, that's a much more logical way of thinking it. I'm like, he's bluffing and he's just got balls of steel in this moment because he knows that he's going to tell anyway, so he doesn't care. But that makes much more sense that the newspaper is pretty much forcing his hand because the power of the press still mattered back then.
Exactly.
People were actually doing real reporting, real policing.
If Bunny really was playing his hand right, he would have shared those letters of appreciation with the Sun reporter.
That
showed like support from the local community, from all the ministers and businessmen about how he's cleaning up their corners. Like, that could have driven the story in the right direction, perhaps. I don't know.
Brilliant, man.
Could have affected policy reform or change. Who knows? But, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a great point.
Instead, that just gets it gets siphoned off to Commissioner Burrell and Rawls, who basically, like, laugh it off. And then, like, when Burrell is taking the heat from Mayor Clarence Royce, he brings up the letters, and they're like, you know, what the fuck? Like, what, like... And then it just like that issue just kind of disappears as to, you know, if it was, you know, publicized in the press, it might have given the Baltimore residents more fat to chew on, like more things to consider with the whole experiment in the rear view. So.
Yeah, that's man. When Willie RP for mayor.
Nah. It's going to be Willie RIP by the time we're done with this.
Wait, are you actually in charge of the simulation? You know what's going to happen.
Nah.
So, yeah. we pretty much, yeah, that's great, yeah. Man. We got into that. You want to talk about old Cuddy?
Yeah.
Someone who's definitely intertwined with Hamsterdam, but yeah. In a much different way. I mean, by the end of this, we're going to say he also deserves like a stack of, well, he gets his appreciation, you know, in other ways. The community yeah. members, residents, certain residents show their appreciation, not through letters necessarily.
Yeah, like a lot of his students' moms want to have sex with him. So that's...
yeah, really just gets to the point. There. Yeah, yeah. Cuddy, man, he is... Yeah. He's linking up with the deacon to, you know, go over his progress to this point.
Right.
Get some compliments.
Yeah, he's getting some compliments. He's getting some good progress, but he also has to grapple with his old self when he brings a lot of kids into the boxing gym and they start kind of like teasing him and ragging on him and saying like, yo, man, like I just saw you cop, you know, the other week. And then he gets in his face. Ooh. Like there's about to be a physical confrontation again, man. Like, as we've seen before in the show, getting roasted by little kids is like, that's worse. That's worse than getting shot to death or getting like your arms and legs chopped off. Like that's worse. That, like, getting humiliated like that is probably so much worse than getting, like, a lecture from a bunny like Carver did. Like,
I don't know about arms getting chopped off. I'd rather get F-sterday word by the corner boys.
Yeah.
I mean, he just, you know, these kids are, this is their one, like, maybe they don't even realize it yet. They're going to have such a, you know, positive place to maybe... you know, work off some of the trauma, their experiences, but maybe they're doing it already, just not in a very constructive way by right. being able to be in a space where they could, you know, abuse someone, even if
verbally. That's,
yeah, like yeah. they're doing it verbally, but I mean, that kid was just running for his life, saw his friend or yeah. someone get shot. Like, I mean, it's unfortunately normalized to them at this point, but right. you know, that's all they like got jokes about. Unfortunately, they just hang out in a drug zone their entire day. So
like, yeah, well, I mean, it's just like, it's also kind of represents like a turning point for Cuddy's character because he's coming up against like some of the challenges he's going to have to face with, you know, training troubled youth and like not he hasn't really taken into account that they're seeing a lot of like the same traumatic shit he's probably had to see all his life. So he's not as understanding in this moment when they're, you know, projecting their own insecurities onto him.
Yeah, so. We talk about that old school versus new school type thing, and, exactly, and you know how yeah. how fitting that it's, you know, the king, the ex kingpin himself, who's like, I don't know how to relate to these youngsters these days. You know, it's yeah. crazy out here, and that's literally like little Melvin's post jail work, as far as, you know, trying to get out and speak to the youth about changing and all that kind of stuff. So reform, yeah. reform.
Got Brother Moonzone reemerging into the universe, and you were kind of perplexed about his little interaction with Vincent. Like, how did they ever seem like they would run in the same circles, especially when Avon was the one to get Brother Moonzone involved in you know, the territorial beef from last season.
Yeah, I mean, I'm skeptical of any interaction with Vincent, you know? But yeah, if you want the intel, you got to go see the Vinners, man. You got to look into those, and they'll tell you everything you need to know.
I mean, I'm just skeptical of Vincent that he'll try to recruit me into, like, a for-profit college.
Yeah. Come on, Willie. You don't need to be here, like, trying to get that government cheese. Just... I got a business proposition. He's like a yeah. proposition Davis.
Yeah.
But
I got to go to ITT Tech.
canceled. But in all seriousness, is there any prior you know, relationship or any evidence?
It's just bizarre. I mean,
right there, rim source, baby. I'm coming.
I mean, in a lot of ways, Brother Monzon shows himself to be more like Omar than they would have recognized, because it seems like he's just kind of like an individual that's playing both sides and kind of just a free agent or whatever. I mean, like, he's definitely like a more friendly to like the organized aspect of organized crime, because, you know, he's like a gun for hire or whatever when Omar just works by himself. But yeah, Brother Monzon seems like he just kind of answers to no man and will talk to people on opposing sides of this nasty little war that's going on at this moment.
Yeah. And Benson, you know, he knows, he's got his ear to the streets though, because he provides him with pretty much the intel that is the, you know, focal point of Brother Monzon and Lamar's work this episode, where he, you know, insinuates that Omar's gay.
Yeah.
And we've probably talked about this, how, like you just said, they're kind of more similar than they might even realize, Omar and Brother, but they also lead starkly different lifestyles. Right. One's a conservative, you know, Muslim, Muslim guy, and the other's, you know, Omar. So,
yeah.
But he has a plan for that. And it's Lamar.
Yeah.
We'll send him into the fray.
Yeah.
Because his homophobia is so visceral.
Yeah, this is the episode where we see Lamar going into a bunch of different gay bars in an effort to track down Omar, and we see Rawl sitting in one of them in the, like,
okay, you just went for it. You're like, this is it. I'm not burying the lead. Like, I know I do that. But yeah, it's just like Lamar, man, first of all, DeAndre's a really good actor, right?
Yeah, he is.
Like, really good. I mean, yeah. Maybe that, I don't remember him being like ardently homophobic in the corner, but maybe, like, if Simon picked up on something, do you think he'd be that guy to be like, yeah, we're going to make DeAndre go, even though it's just acting, like, he's going to be super, like, that anger is going to be,
I don't know.
I don't want to insinuate things, but, you know, I just want, yeah, credit where credit's due. He acts like he's really good at acting homophobic. Yeah. And, you know, his aggressive nature and just, you know, Brother Monzon had the foresight to see this, you know, I mean, foresight, obviously, with the situation, that it's gonna rustle something up, which it eventually does, and Dante, you know,
right,
taking the bait. But you want to talk Rawls, because you brought it up, and I kind of just was, I'm like, well, you brought that up. All right, let me, like, talk about things that aren't that, and then get back to probably one of the singularly most bizarre occurrences twist in the show. Yeah, it's just... And I was asking, like, okay, what is the real, you know, because there's all this, there's this background from the, you know, reading we've done and all that, but it's
just so funny, because for as layered as so much of the stuff on this show is, they were just like, hey, yeah, let's throw in this little detail about, you know, Rawls being closeted. I mean, yeah, that's pretty much like where that ends, right? We don't really, I mean, I guess in season 4, Jay Landsman sees some bathroom graffiti that says Rawl sucks cock or something.
Oh yeah, I forgot that. But that's crazy.
It's just like, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, he looks happy in that environment. Like, he's not like malicious or anything. Like, just like a hint at like this whole inner secret life that we don't know anything about, and, you know, we don't really need to know anything about it other than this brief little appearance, really.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, because one of the, you know, things, the texts we've called back on a lot, All the Pieces Matter, they kind of allude to that whole scenario. And John Doman was like, or Doman?
Yeah.
Doman.
You know.
He was like, okay, yeah, you got something crazy going on? Sure, I'm all in, whatever it is. And he's like, oh, shoot, okay. Well, I didn't know where it was going to go. But then, you know, like, Simon just pretty much,
yeah,
left it there. I don't know. I can't really remember if they had actual plans, but yeah, it was like Vess left, you know.
Yeah. Fuck the average viewer.
Less is more. Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Plus, Rawls has had a really, you know, he's had a rough day. Like, at this point,
I don't think the Comstat meeting happens.
I was about to say, that'd be too perfect. But anyways, yeah, they, you know, Dante's getting himself kidnapped, right?
Yeah,
basically. Because brother's so disciplined. He's going like, you know, he's Omar basically in this scenario, right? Because he's basically just been standing in the rain or in the shadow of a row house, like sheltering, just waiting for this moment where someone follows him out.
Yeah.
Knowing all along that Lamar probably wouldn't get, he would never get intel based on his behavior around gay people. So like, this is pretty much the only scenario that he figured out. Figured like, yeah, some he's going to piss someone off so bad, they're going to come after him or something.
Yeah, there's no way like someone like would see Lamar coming in and like the way he's like so aggressive about it. They'd be like, oh yeah, let me tell you everything I know.
Yeah, you got great people skills, you know? Jeez.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't know where I am.
Brother Muzon, I think he kind of like takes advantage of Lamar's thickness in a lot of ways.
Like, it only be family, right? That's what someone, a creator, has said.
Yeah.
Like, how dumb Lamar is sometimes to, that's the only way they'd be able to stand.
Yeah.
And plus, we know brother is in town also gonna, well, he's hunting for Bodhi and Pooh, right? For making fun of what could be his niece or Arlita Muzon, who they were talking about is like loose, you know?
Yeah.
It's bad. Okay. All simulation. And Carchetti.
Yeah, Carchetti, he's ramping up, you know, his campaign and getting on board with a lot of these ideas, but he's having second thoughts about selling out his friend Tony Gray and, like, you know, picking apart his, like, electability and arguments and stuff and, like, strategizing how, you know, if he gets in the race, you know, he'll need him to, like, be in the race so that he could split the black vote and, triumphant, so.
And his super inclusive white friends are like, you know what, we need black faces in our campaign because I really like him. I think they're super hardworking. Like, they're, you know, not part of any, they're not the cause of any problems in this city. I just love it, you know, I love the culture.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. but does Carchetti have, you know, is he showing some of, is he bearing some of his soul? Like, that actually, like, it exists. He does have a conscience.
Like, there is conscience and, you know, stuff going on. But in the end, he's just going to end up making decisions that are going to benefit himself. Like, he sees, like, that Tony's a good guy and that, like, he's, you know, going after a viable issue in, you know, school reform and education or whatever. But he just knows that that's not going to be like a selling point or it's going to be like sexy enough to get somebody elected. So he's just going to let him like keep going on, you know, that path that's going to get him nowhere while he exploits the awkwardness of this three-way race.
Yeah, man. School reform, it won't get you anywhere because I was just finishing some boring, well, not boring, but like more dry reading. Before I was like, I'm going to finish this book before I get to the fun stuff, which We Own the City, even though it's not fun to read. I mean, it's terrible stuff.
Yeah,
but
it's gripping, though.
Because
things are so fucked up.
Yeah, but apparently, so Kurt Schmoke's whole thing was education. And then, of course, O'Malley was all about crime. So this makes sense. Yeah. I didn't really know that. So sneaky Carchetti.
But yeah, Butchie, he reveals to Omar that he knew the whereabouts of the Barksdales all along, and he knows where the funeral home.
Tompkins, yeah.
Yeah.
Butchie's been holding on me, too, because I was trying to find it for a while. For a minute, I've been like, man, where is this? Because it doesn't exist. It's called Serenity Funeral Services now, but it's the same location. It's on McCullough.
Yeah.
I won't get too into the details. So, got a map coming.
Yeah. So Butchie was giving you a good morsel there too.
There's nothing better than Butchie confirming, like providing confirmation. You're like, yes, I knew
it. So in this part of the simulation, you're standing in for Omar.
Oh, shit. Oh, man.
This is hurting my brain.
Yeah.
I don't, like, I'm having like trouble tracking to how we got to this.
Yeah. Butchie's all, you know, we'll work back because I got some stuff about what Butchie was leading off with, but Yeah, I mean, he was hesitant to tell Omar, of course, because,
yeah,
I mean, you know, he's looking out, he cares for him, and he knows what's going to happen eventually. Right. But I think, you know, he also trusts Omar's skill set and the way he conducts himself too, right? Because obviously we see Omar when we're talking about the Barksdale soon, but he's doing some recon and he's not obviously walking at them guns blazing. He's just like, I don't even know where he's hiding. He's like behind some screen, like a shed somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, you know, empty row house maybe.
Yeah.
Fortunately, a epidemic of those things. But Butchie, you know, providing us some breadcrumbs to the Wire universe, talking about the war between Kenny Bird and Peanut. So just getting to that first, you know, and basically in 1981, there was a pretty brief, but I guess, you know, intense war in the Lafayette Court or Lafayette Court's housing project in East Baltimore. Mm-hmm. So basically, yeah, Kenny Bird Jackson, who's affiliated with Little Melvin, but basically he was involved, or he was, you know, his group or faction was selling drugs out of Lafayette Courts. Like, literally, as we're talking about this, there's helicopters starting. I'm like, holy shit. And then Peanut King was coming from the east side, like, I'm going to take over. So I'm like, oh, man, is Peanut King coming for us, Willie? But, yeah, so he was like, I want some of that, because it was very lucrative, obviously, in the high-rises and stuff. And then they went at it. But it wasn't like a downer situation, because what I found just from, like, a few little snippets and here and there, it was just like some shootouts and people got injured, but I don't know. Like, there wasn't a huge amount of death, but I'm sure it existed. But maybe that's a little topic for research too. It's like the little mini East Side version of the war on the downers and stuff. So yeah, that's basically what Butchie's talking about. But Kenny Bird Jackson's so crazy, because we talk like everywhere from like local politics to the, you know, longshoreman stuff. Remember, he's like the guy who had like fake cards and all that stuff and strip clubs. So he's kind of like if Stringer actually succeeded in development,
right? You know? Yeah,
like if he was like Kenny Bird opened the news and was like nine, like I am one of the nine developers who got my funds. I mean, he's like donated, yeah, politics. He was involved with Lawrence Bell, who's like probably inspired Anthony Gray, and even donated to Kurt Schmoke's campaign. It's like, we could do a whole podcast on that guy. But, and I know I've talked about this previously as well, but his like web of chaos in Baltimore was so far reaching that he even was implicated with Wayne Jenkins. And I talk about this all that, but come on, man, just because we're both reading We Own the City, this is from Justin Fenton article, right? And from 2018. Bell bondsman and admitted drug dealer Donald C. Stepp testified Thursday that Jenkins supplied him for years with drugs taken off of the streets and they split profits. During defense questioning, Stepp said Jenkins also identified high-stakes targets who they tracked and stole from. Stepp testified that they tracked Jackson's, Kenny Bird's, silver Acura to a Sam's Club parking lot and stole between $12,000 to $19,000 from the car. So basically, in response to this, though, Kenny, keeping it cool, is like, I've never been robbed, especially by a rat punk like him. So he's way ahead of his time, Kenny Bird Jackson. So, I mean, not to, like, committed a lot of crimes. It's been talked about on Wires, like, where they're like, yeah, he's a killer, but he's a nice guy, you know? But, I mean, come on, he respected Sunday truces, and he called Wayne Jenkins a rat punk. So, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know what that gets him, but so pretty wild stuff.
Yeah.
That was intense, though, man.
So we have this whole internal strife going on in the Barksdale organization with Stringer trying to cool the conflict between Avon and Marlo. And Avon is like, no thanks. Hey, check out this grenade my friend got for me. It's like, it's like some more stuff that like I didn't realize. Like, oh yeah, this is like, he's literally bringing in like military grade equipment and stuff. This is like the Iraq War.
Yeah, so is that, that's who would have brought it to him, right? He said a friend,
right?
Who's, yeah, like in a combat
overseas, so, from wherever, like, so, he doesn't even know.
So he's like, I don't need to be like those guys they made movies about who brought a bunch of heroin from Vietnam back. It's like, I want grenades from Iraq, you know?
Exactly.
Man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, what do you think about the, I mean, they're obviously on such different levels, and just everything's going to shit, basically. But String goes to have a meeting with Prop Joe.
Yeah, they give him an ultimatum.
Yeah, so he's meeting. I was asking initially in the notes, like, who are these other characters? And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, it's Fat Face Rick and Phil Boy.
Yeah, I recognize Fat Face Rick.
And so yeah, he gives him an ultimatum that he's going to get cut out of the co-op's package if he doesn't get a hold of Avon and try to get Marlo to the table. But did you see what I got on Phil Boy,
he's
the actor?
Taekwondo.
That's all it said. You know, maybe you have some similarities with him.
No, come on.
But this is from his IMDb page, and you have more experience in this world, so I want to like get your thoughts on what this biography is all about, or if this is like, just, okay, listen. So he's Show Brown is his name, and he goes by Swordsman. Show Swordsman Brown. S-H-O. Yeah. Show Brown is a great and very kind man. A 10th Dan Grandmaster and skilled in various martial arts such as Taekwondo, Kenpo, Hapkido, Ninjutsu, Karate, Aikido, Wushu. Show is skilled in handling weapons.
That is definitely sounds like he wrote his own biography.
I'm like, is this normal? Or it's like you work at an office job and they're like, submit your biographies. And then half of people are just like, okay. Yeah. And you, so like, you're like, I always thought like, this is a really complicated thing, but you just write it yourself. But then I thought, like, for sure, IMDb seems pretty complicated, but then people just write their own biographies. Yeah.
Unless like you have like, you know, like a whole team and you're fucking Tom Cruise, I think you're gonna like be writing your own shit.
But I also have like an alternate theory where let me read the rest of it, because I thought the same thing. Like, it's obvious that Sho is writing this.
Yeah.
But then it goes, he's taking acting classes, studied in Baltimore, and is very serious in becoming a good actor in addition to his work as a stunt performer, prepared to work hard and reach all of his goals. Show already appeared in several commercials, shows such as Mortal Kombat Conquest and WMAC Masters. Show's manager and talent agent is Zo Kim, also a martial artist who appeared in MK Conquest. Then I'm like, wait, it's Zo Kim who's writing this, and is like, let me plug my own stuff. Like, oh, Zo Kim, you know, his coach is a great and very kind man too. Like, what if it just started that?
Yeah.
Anyways, so, I don't know.
They're just giving themselves props.
Yeah. Pretty wild stuff. But anyways, Phil Boy, man, he's, you know, he's an interesting character. Show Brown does a good job for show.
Exactly. Is that the one who talks about his wife's fat pussy or something? Or is that?
No, that's Fat Face Rick.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. I'm not necessarily endorsing the language of my co-
It was a line from the episode. Yeah,
I know. But he's they're getting a little. They're sick of Stringer and Abel. I mean, he's like blowing smoke literally in String's face.
Yeah,
and it's like, okay, maybe, yeah, we're so used to seeing them in this almighty, you know, playing God and all right, kill that kid, do this, and we're like, oh man, like. Okay, yeah, there are two sides to the city. There's a lot of other players involved. Yeah. And, he has grenades, but String is just like, this guy in a suit, bewildered.
Right. And he's getting upset about being cut out of, like, the development race or whatever. Like, he's not going as far and as fast as he thought he was. And Clay Davis is doing foul play and whatever. How... I just want to bring attention to that scene, the very pivotal scene where Stringer makes the decision to snitch on Avon. Yeah. How great is that scene handled, like, with the amount of restraint that they're showing the filmmakers, that is, like, with him just, like, stuck in that, like, you know, side little office with the sound of the copy machine going, kind of representing, like, I don't know, all the different thoughts that are going through Stringer's head at this moment with, like, all the crises he's having to manage. And, like, definitely the first time I watched this, I didn't realize, like, that's what he was doing in that moment, is that he was, like, deciding to betray Avon. Yeah. And, like, you know, getting a leg up on this chess game.
Yeah, I'm right there, because he, you know, he's had brilliantly handled and phenomenal acting, where he picks up the office phone and he's like hesitant, and I'm thinking to myself, wait, he's about, like, this is this, no, okay, yeah, he's not gonna do it.
Yeah,
and then he picks up his cell phone. Yeah. I was like, oh shit, yeah, he's doing it. So, man, a lot of snitching all around in this episode.
Yeah, like
Herschel and.
Yeah, but at least Stringer feels bad about it.
Yeah. Herc wouldn't, he wouldn't even, yeah. I mean, he wouldn't get to this point.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, man, so, I mean, I got another question, and I might go on a little tangent if you don't mind, but, so, you know, in that very tense scene where there's a disconnect on display between Avon and String, Avon gets word right then, you know, that it's obvious, like, what the message is, that Devon got murdered. And I'm like, oh, he's not going to even share that with String. But then he's like, you know what just happened? You know, she got murdered. So who was Devon to them? Is that like a family member to Avon too? Or, I mean, because in the same breath, it's like my cousin or someone, you know, she has, you know, as Slim Charles.
Oh, yeah, with the fat ass. They're getting intel on Omar and whatnot.
I love to, all I have to do is just do something like this. You're like, eh. Like, yeah. Thank you. Making my life easier. But I don't know. Who, like, he seems upset. I mean, it's just, is it like, oh, the plan failed? I'm upset.
I don't know if they, like, ever got really deep into, like, her specific connection in the crew, but it seemed like, you know, that she was a reliable honeypot that they would use to their advantage to seduce their enemies into like a state of comfort before they killed them, you know.
I learned that word from you, honeypot. Yeah. I'm like, oh man, that sounds like something from like a,
it's problematic,
like,
term,
like
for
a Raekwon album or something. Like, oh, what innuendo is this?
Yeah, it's not a term that's looked upon with much kindness these days.
Yeah.
It's problematic, but...
But talk about problematic. Marlo, man.
Yeah, he shoots Devon in each breast and then in the mouth.
Yeah. And it's just like cold, like, smoke coming out of her mouth. There's no... There's no, like... It's just... I mean, you know, it's for the quality of the shot, but it's just, like, poetic and how brutal he is.
Marlo is so, like, dispassionate and, like, cold and calculating in what he does. In this episode, it made me think about, too, you know, the scene several episodes ago where he has sex with Devon. And I'm like, how did he even, like, you know, it's kind of awkward to bring up, but, like, how did he muster up enough excitement to even, like, do the deed in that moment? Because he's so, like, you know, cagey all the time. Like, I can't even see him getting excited about something like that.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's a fair point to make, I think, even if a little problematic, but no. But, I mean, and Chris is standing, like, he just kind of, like, lurks out of the shadows, like, it had to be done. Like, could you imagine him in his awkward role of, you know, bang bus, like, security, you know, like, just when he pops out, he's like, hey, Marla, it had to be done.
Wait, bang bus security? What?
And that's not, like, a banga akana
guy. Oh, fuck.
That's problematic.
I thought you said bang bus, like the pornograph.
That's what you're the one who brought that up. You're like, how awkward would it be to have, because we were talking about awkward security, like Shamrock's job's awkward, Chris's job, because he's like basically guarding the bank. Like,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then I'm like, oh, is that a what do you call that? Like a double, like, you know, the actor plays Chris Banga, like Bang Bus.
There we go.
No, that's
now nah, I'm on board. I get what you're saying.
Oh, you're on board? Oh, okay. Good luck, man.
Yeah.
How cold and calculating you are. But okay, this is getting like solid simulation. But I mean, yeah, he's like, you know, like it had to be done. Does Marlo need to be told? Like, is he offering him some sort of like conscience, like advice for his conscience? I mean, Marlo doesn't like what kind of like, yeah, what do you mean it need to be done? Like, I did it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like Marlo's the type of person that needs to be talked off of a ledge, or like he doesn't need to be like reassured that he's doing the right thing.
This is not a citizen.
Yeah.
But is it time to talk a little Marlo composition? Because please. I know that you've kind of brought some things to my attention. You're like, is this legit? Or like, look at this story. I'm like, yeah, Tony Two Tones is legit. Like,
yeah.
And you're like, I mean, you know. I'm like, I'm sorry, but it had to be done. I had to tell you that he's legit. No. But I mean, basically what I'm referencing is Willie sent me a video from a YouTuber named Tony Two Times who makes videos. Are you good? You're like,
yeah,
just, can you listen? Like, can you hear?
I just don't know if I remember like anything that he talked about in that video.
That's good. That's what I'm saying. Okay. Like, I mean, it's not good because, like, you should pay close attention to Tony Two Times. But, and that's why we make a joke sometimes, like, Yaki Two Times, because I've listened to some of his stuff, but I also, you know, basically, Tony Two Times is from Baltimore and he knows a lot about the streets and, you know, he does his research. But I'm just saying that what we're doing here is strictly like, I mean, you can say what you want about the Baltimore Sun being a deep state rag, but, you know, I get a lot of the information from there and archives and stuff.
Yeah, that's a joke, by the way.
Yeah, it's a joke. Some lady commented on a story that I sent to Willie and I didn't know he was referencing the comment. So, like on the story, so I just like, really, deep state rag? Or I was just having like a I was like, whatever, having a day. So I was like, of course he would say that.
Yeah,
but I knew you were joking. I just didn't know it was literally like a probably middle-aged woman commenting on some, I can't remember the story. I mean, basically the story that I'm referencing is about two characters, real life street characters, Marlo Daniels and Tamir Stanfield, who, you know, it's self-explanatory who they represent or, you know, what their stories inspired. And I'm here to say that, yeah, after doing, you know, some research, reading stories about these two, Marlo's tendencies don't really seem to be too far off from these guys. And, you know, happened a long time ago, mid-80s. Basically, they grew up in Westport, which is, it's called the Patch, and it's like, it's Southwest, but it's not what generally is referred to as Southwest. It's basically, I think, just a development, you know, it's like a housing project for workers, segregated, where maybe even under D'Alessandro Jr., the mayor, like, there are, you know, like, you know, not in my backyard stuff, like, build projects for workers, but in the most secluded area. So it's just like trapped between, you know, the river and freeways and stuff. So it's pretty rough. And then they moved into the Murphy homes in Lexington Terrace, pretty much as like Melvin and those guys are wrapping up getting their sentences. So they were like really brutal, but I think they started a little earlier. Like the timelines overlapped, like in the early 80s, they were first getting started in the Murphy homes, like 82. Yeah, I mean, they're half brothers, apparently.
Mm.
But Tamir was more of the leader of the group, I think. And Marlo was racking up the bodies. So he was like the enforcer, this guy. Like some of the stuff, I mean, we're talking about, yeah, I mean, it's not as detailed as, you know, all the things we're seeing with Marlo. I know it's all simulation and it's all like based on this and that. But there was a guy named Robert Hilton Bay. And I've mentioned that before. I think I'm like, where's like, who is Wee Bay? Like, why does he have the Bay in it? And I think in our discussion a long time ago, I was like, Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about like in this book, Beautiful Struggle, about growing up in Baltimore. Like, oh, when the Hilton Bays came through, like Murphy homes. And I'm like, holy crap. That's like, unfortunately I learned about it in a story about someone with the name getting killed. But basically One of the murders he's implicated in, I think there were three that he got charged with, Marlo Daniels, and convicted for, I think, all of them. But apparently this guy, Robert Hilton Bay, worked for Marlo Daniels and Tamir Stanfield in the Murphy homes. And wow. He was trying to clear out a lobby area, or like a courtyard of like, you know, it was getting too hot or whatever. Like, you know, too many people were trying to sell drugs here. And he tried to like show out Marlo and was like, okay, it's time to go. And he's like, you don't know who I am? And then he just killed him right there. Jeez. He's like, you work for me. So that's like a very Marlo thing to do. And then the other one was, so I don't even know what to think about this. There was a guy sitting on a bench and he jumped on the table and he just like, he killed in front of kids. And this guy's name was Elwood Jerome Farmer. Mm. And Lamont Chin Farmer's brother was named Elwood Farmer. I'm like, no way that Marlo Daniels killed Chin's brother, but apparently that was a mistaken identity. So I did a little digging to see if, like, because they don't ever say the middle name of Lamont Chin Farmer's brother, but he was like around 40 when Lamont Chin Farmer was getting, you know, like when they were getting investigated, Lil Melvin and all of them, and it was all falling apart, and he was on drugs and frustrated, you know, Lamont Chin Farmer, like maybe like Shamrock would frustrate String. And so I'm thinking like, and then reading Simon's article, there's this one thing where they use like an undercover guy from Annapolis or like an informant to get with Elwood Farmer to then try to get to Chin Farmer.
Right.
And I'm like, holy shit, did Chin Farmer like figure out his brother was involved with the cops somehow, even if he didn't even know because he was doing drugs, and then like have Marlo kill him like a year later after he got in trouble and arrested? I'm like, no way. Because I don't know, like I found some Elwood Farmers in news stories, but it's like Elwood L. Farmer got arrested and he was like 21 in 1965. And then Elwood Farmer, Chin's brother, was like around 40 in 1985, so I'm like, or 1984. So I'm like, maybe, you know, he was doing drugs for a long time, getting arrested for like breaking and entering, and that's his brother, not the guy who Marlo killed. So that's all I'm trying to get at. But it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And then they killed another guy like who witnessed one of the murders named Joseph Davis. And that's where like Tamir got busted too. And that was like 1986. So yeah, they're killing witnesses. And apparently, now this was the first, what they, the first person they killed was like the first scene of the show where a security guard who was right there was like, I was reading like a lollipop wrapper when they killed him. I didn't see anything. So that was maybe like Nikisha Lyles. Cause I thought like, oh, that's like a Nathan Barksdale story, but a lot goes into this. And then they also had, one more thing I've been wanting to clear up for a long time, because I know I talk about Kenny Bird Jackson being like Stringer and like, oh, Bird, you know, Kenny Bird. But one of their muscle who was charged with the murder of this guy, Joseph Davis, who witnessed one of the other murders that Marlo committed, was named Antonio Barnes, who was Bird.
Oh, shit.
So that's Bird.
Wow.
Yeah, not like Kenny Bird necessarily. So, but yeah, man.
All the pieces matter.
All the pieces matter, and then everything scatters because assimilation, like, the bubble bursts. But yeah, so thanks for sticking with me. I'm sorry.
No problem.
We'll. Yeah. So crazy stuff, man. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Cool. Well.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We really appreciate you sticking with us through all of that. We had a lot to talk about, and we're glad you could join us. Great episode, Reformation, Season 3, Episode 10. Getting excited about what's coming up.
Yeah, we're excited, too. And, you know, you might see that reflected in some of our social media posts and trying to engage, you know, if you're out there, you got anything you want to say, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
Exactly.
Gods Will Not Save You. It's pretty much more or less similar domain. So, right. Looking forward.
Right. If anybody has any questions, comments, or concerns, you could always reach out to us via email at thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com.
Great. Yeah. And also, we wanted to thank our creative support, Mostart, doing some really awesome work and allowing us to utilize that to our advantage with the intro and outro and some bumpers. So check him out, Mostart.com. He's got new stuff coming out, right? Like MF Doom. I mean, I got to ask you about that. Yeah. I need to learn more about that and classic stuff. RIP.
Yeah, I'll look into that as well. He's a great guy. And you know who else is a great guy? Oh. We want to thank is Andre Tesnes, who did our great podcast logo. We'd be nowhere without his design work.